COVID-19 is spreading within our prisons. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. One prison in the Panhandle now has 40 confirmed cases. In facilities across the state, testing is starting up and more cases are being discovered. Is enough being done to protect corrections staff and inmates? Also, since the pandemic started, more people have begun to think about their wills. We're going to talk with an attorney to understand what needs to go into your will and why it shouldn't just be something that the elderly put together. Finally, nonprofits are beginning to feel the economic pinch of the pandemic. Community foundations are trying to help many of these groups stay afloat. But is there enough money to do it? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Coronavirus is continuing to spread across Florida, including into our state's prisons. One of the worst stories has been out of the Blackwater River Correctional Facility in the Panhandle, where there have been dozens of cases. What protections are in place for prisoners and staff? Are there enough cleaning supplies? Well, we're joined now by WLRN's Danny Rivero. Danny, always great to have you.
Great to be here.
So has the Florida Department of Corrections started a program to test inmates and employees?
So the Florida Department of Corrections is largely leaving those decisions to the county level Department of Health. And one thing to remember is the majority of the prisons in the state prison system are happening in they're located in very rural areas of the state, largely in North Florida and on the Panhandle. And some of those departments of health are very small when you compare them to some of the larger counties that we have here in South Florida. But as of this moment, the State Department of Corrections they say that they're isolating any inmates that might have symptoms of COVID-19, but they're letting the Department of Health at the county level administer the test and decide which inmates should be tested.
So what do we know about testing of employees and inmates in Miami-Dade County?
So I was just looking at the data in the state prison system. It doesn't look like there's any cases here in Miami-Dade County, but we do have, of course, the local county jails and the local prison system. I'm sorry, the local jail system here in Miami-Dade is the biggest in the state. And so far, there have been at least 15 confirmed cases of jail officials that have tested positive. And just last week, the Miami-Dade Department of Corrections did confirm that one inmate in the TGK facility, it's a place where a lot of people go when they're first booked, has tested positive. So we now have the first case here in South Florida.
So we have.
I'm sorry, in Miami-Dade.
Yeah, we have this information. Does that mean that, you know, these departments are being transparent about what's going on?
You know, it's one of the characteristics of the prison or the jail system is that there's not a lot of transparency when it comes to getting access. You know, you can't just walk in. And so that obviously presents a layer of concern for people that are trying to track this. You know, on different levels, at the state level, they have been issuing some data, and we do see that there is a number of prisons across the state that have just a few cases of the employees and the contract staff testing positive. But right now in the state prison system, they're only listing two facilities that have any inmates that have tested positive.
So does that, I'm wondering, like, I mean, that's for us, like, you know, the media trying to get information, but I wonder if families and relatives are having a hard time trying to figure out what's going on with their loved ones behind bars.
Right. Well, you know, that speaks to concerns that advocacy groups and family groups have been, you know, calls that they've been making to the different levels of the criminal justice system ever since, you know, this outbreak really became apparent. Incarcerated is probably the worst place to be if you're looking at a situation like this, because, you know, if you're in a crowded cell.
All right, I think that I've lost Danny. Danny, you still there? All right. We may have lost the connection with Danny Rivero. Again, I've been talking with WLRN's reporter Danny Rivero. And again, talking about concerns that inmates and correction staff are facing when it comes to this coronavirus pandemic. You know, what is happening right now within these facilities? Are the inmates being tested? Are all the staff being tested? Do we know exact numbers? And what are they doing when it comes to social distancing? Are they isolating people if something is actually happening? If we do have positive cases, are they distancing these people? If by any chance you happen to know someone who is incarcerated anywhere in South Florida or within the Florida prison system or jail system, and you have any information, you can always find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear from you. Or you can always email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. We'd love to hear these stories because we're trying to get the answers as well. I want to turn things over now to Kathy Klarich, founder and executive director of Exchange for Change. Kathy, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for inviting me.
And tell me, first of all, a little bit about the organization. What is Exchange for Change and the work that you do within within prisons?
So Exchange for Change is a local South Florida-based nonprofit that has two components to our mission. The first one is to go into correctional institutions and teach writing courses of all kinds, anything from the normal genres of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry to memoir, writing on trauma, writing in Spanish, literature, Shakespeare, playwriting. So one objective is to give those who are incarcerated better communication skills. And then the other, honestly, Lewis, is to educate the population about who the incarcerated are. So we try and bring the voices of the incarcerated out to the community, because eventually more than three quarters of people who are incarcerated will be returning, and we want to give them a fair shake.
So right now your organization is also helping in this coronavirus era by providing soap and hand sanitizers, correct?
Yeah. So what we did when we were part of the whole group that is now no longer inside, because the Department of Corrections, rightfully so, has isolated the population in order to try and keep Corona from coming inside, we can't teach our classes. So we're trying to do some of it by correspondence, sending in curriculums. But we also joined with other organizations around the state. We're part of what's called the Florida Coalition for Higher Education in Prison. So there are four groups that put in some seed money, started a GoFundMe campaign, and within the last week, 10 days, we've been able to raise over $10,000. And buy about 10,000 bars of soap and 50 gallons of hand sanitizer to distribute among eight correctional institutions and two correctional institutions for the staff. So the population and the staff.
And you're going to be making one of those deliveries. You want to go with the delivery and make sure that it's getting in there. And you even want to, you know, be able to see where, you know, how it's being distributed, right?
Well, that would be the ideal, but that's not going to happen only because they're not letting everybody inside the prison grounds, which makes perfect sense. So the soap is being sent directly from the distributor into the institution warehouse, where we're assuming it's going to get delivered, one bar of soap per inmate. And then the hand sanitizer was put together by a very smart young entrepreneur who was able to connect with a local company that was doing beauty products that have switched over to hand sanitizer. He procured a shipment for us. We're waiting for the containers to fill, 1 gallon containers, and to deliver those containers to two institutions in South Florida.
Yeah, Kathy, what are you hearing about, you know, what's going on within these facilities? You know, as again, we've entered this very strange time, but you know, this is a population that, again, they're kind of all clustered into this, you know, into these little areas, and so they are at risk. But what kind of things have you heard?
So I've been in constant contact with the Department of Corrections from Tallahassee, which has been instrumental in helping us secure access to be able to get the supplies inside. and then with a couple of the assistant warden of programs at the very institutions where we work. And just to give you sort of a framework, Lewis, Florida has the third largest prison population in the country. We have nearly 95,000 people inside, and we've got, I think, probably close to 25,000 people on staff, right? So it's the staff that's coming in and out, and through no fault of their own, are probably going to be the ones that infect the population. So you have to figure people are living in one of two conditions inside Florida prisons. They're either in a two-person cell for the most part, which I think is like 6 by 9 feet, or they're in what's called an open bay, where there are about 60 beds that are side by side. So the very setup of the prison is not conducive to social distancing. So the steps that I know that they have taken was during recreation and during their meal service, they're trying to social distance people. But when you think about it, they're lining up, they're living next to each other. It's not a setup. If people do become ill, they can go to the medical building, and they can also be put in isolation, not for anything that they've done, but in order to try and protect them from one another. But I think, you know, just the very nature of the way the prison is set up is really working against all of the things that we would be able to do on the outside.
Do you see, because again, you spent a lot of time working with inmates, teaching them, but you can't do that anymore. Now you've switched over to make sure you can get these kind of supplies in. Do you see having to make that switch for a while?
Boy, I sure hope not, but I think everyone is on the same page, including the Department of Corrections, is they don't want people coming back in before it is safe. They have to come up with ways to be able to test people before they go in and when they come out. But, you know, you also have to think people are being released every day. So what kind of measures are being taken to protect people who have finished their terms that are coming back to the community? So all of those safety measures need to be put in place, and we don't want to sacrifice anything for our own program or the safety of our students by going back in too soon, even though, of course, all of the people who are teaching, and we had more than 30 classes going this semester, you know, we all want to be inside, but we want everybody to be safe.
Kathy Klarich is the founder and executive director of Exchange for Change. Kathy, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, last year, Exchange for Change, along with O Miami Poetry Festival, started Florida's Prison Poet Laureate. Eduardo Martinez, based in Miami-Dade, is the 2019 recipient. Now, he was unable to record his poem in the prison, so his son, Eddie Martinez, did the honors.
There's a lot of different ways to define this sickness. To keep the media encrypted, Made in America, checking off its wish list, Congress clairvoyance, this was all predicted, so stay safe, don't become a statistic. Ironically, social distance is keeping us together like kids on a field trip. We are the world. Let's all sing along to the remix. Different circles coming together entwined like Olympics. We all gotta heal the world. That's always been the pretext. Deep in our hearts, we all share the same suspect and quick to sign off on our gut checks. You're a hostage situation if you come out positive on your check. It's a respiratory attack, so don't wait till your last breath, cause life doesn't come with a reset. She's a bartender that's upset with a tip jar full of all-seeing eyes and pyramids. So when she takes your order and hands you lemons instead, wake up, wake up, wake up, and kiss the lips of a Corona with them. Or hit the snooze button again. But I suggest you keep your eyes open.
And again, that is just a portion of the poem by Eduardo Martinez, the 2019 Florida Prison Poet Laureate. Well, still to come, do you have a will? When should you get one? How the pandemic has gotten us thinking about our mortality. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, one of the most tragic aspects of coronavirus for those that become critically ill is that they have to die alone. That means that people's last wishes and desires have to be determined before they go into the hospital. Bruce Stone is a Miami-based attorney who deals with estate planning and wills. He's gotten a lot of calls and questions from his clients about these issues. And what questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. You could post your question there at WLRN Sundial. And as always, this is not legal advice, just a guidepost. If you have a specific legal question, please ask your attorney. We're joined now by Mr. Stone. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Louis. Glad to be here.
So during this pandemic, when did you start hearing from people about the concerns they have with their wills and their estates?
I started getting alerts and clients being alarmed by the in the early stages of the pandemic. I would say probably late February, early March. People who had been putting off matters some time now feeling the urge to get moving, to get working on them.
And what are some of the common questions that you're getting from folks? Because this isn't your typical setting up a will, you know, and thinking about your estate. This is, oh my God, we're in a situation where you don't know what's going to happen. And there's a lot that has to be planned out, but now we're having to rush.
Yeah, ordinarily people start to think about their estate planning when they, for younger people, when they have children, older people, when they're getting near retirement age. And generally what motivates people is they're worrying about how they're going to leave their assets, where they're going to leave their home, their bank accounts, their retirement plans, their wealth that they've accumulated. What was different about this one is the fear that people are actually going to die. It's not so much a concern about where can I leave my estate when I die, what's going to happen to me in the process of dying, and what can I do to make sure that somebody's going to be there to make sure that my decisions get carried out, that I'm not allowed to suffer, that I'm going to be given the treatment that I need. What can I do?
And again, it's, as you said, it's either when you start by when you start having a family or when you're later in your life. I wonder though, like younger people, do you ever get younger people, you know, coming forward and thinking about this kind of stuff? Or maybe because they're young, they think, nah, it's, I can push this till later.
Well, you're right. It's pretty rare for younger people to worry about estate planning. And even now, I would say even now in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, because for a couple of reasons, younger people just aren't accustomed to thinking about their own mortality. We start to think about our mortality as we get older, you know, as we're nearing the end of our natural lifespans. But also another curious effect is because apparently the less severity of the coronavirus on younger people, not that they don't get it, not they don't get sick, but the fatality rates seem to be less than they are for those of us who are older. So therefore, I think some of the urgency that is older people are feeling is not being shared by members of the population, the younger population.
Again, the number is 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Or you could post your comment or question on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Let us know what you're thinking in moments like this. You know, what kind of questions would you have about your estate? Or have you ever set up a will? And if not, what are the things you need to be asking right now if you think you should be setting up the will? Maybe this coronavirus has got us thinking a little bit more about that. Again, 800-743-9576. You know, Mr. Stone, when you think about setting up a will, you know, sometimes maybe one of the ideas, the thoughts is, well, you know, it's for people who have a property or a couple of properties and a lot of money and a lot of stuff somewhere, and who are you going to pass it on to? But really, you know, it's just the stuff that you have, and you know, it could be a few basic things. Who's going to take control of that, or who's going to be, you know, who's going to have that responsibility? What are some of the things that, you know, you want people to think about, you know, when they're setting up their will, when they're thinking about this kind of stuff?
Well, first of all, you don't really have to be a rich person to need to have a will. For those people who own their home, it doesn't have to be an expensive house. You know, when you die, where is ownership of your house going to go? Who do you want it to go to? Maybe you've got bank accounts that are in your name alone. One point that we do want to make, though, is that for most people, most people won't die with a lot of stuff passing under a will, because most of us have our things set up in accounts where we have beneficiary designations, such as individual retirement accounts, pension plans, bank accounts, brokerage accounts. A lot of those have, you're able to designate beneficiaries, and you can do that online even without having to see an attorney, without having witnesses. But if you have assets that are in your name alone, another example is, for married couples, most married couples have everything that, or substantially everything, in joint names. And when one spouse dies, the surviving spouse will become the owner of what used to be the jointly held asset without having to go through probate and really without having to worry about taxes. But you know, the severity of this pandemic, where spouses who live together, you know, and the prospect that both spouses might get ill and might die, you know, what's going to happen to the joint property if both spouses die? That's when you need a will.
I see. One of the other things, too, I've always wondered about is everything that we have that's digital. And by that, I mean, if I have anything, you know, whether it's my social media accounts, my emails, any account that I have online, and there might be a lot of information on those things, you know, but is it something you would put in your will is basically your passwords? Who gets access to this stuff?
You know, you've just raised a really very critical and extremely important point. Under federal law, the online service providers, Google, Microsoft, Apple, all the other Yahoo, all the companies that provide the online digital services, Facebook, et cetera, are prohibited by federal law from releasing your information about your passwords and so forth without your permission to do so. And a number of people just haven't given their permission. It is possible now because of laws that were passed around almost all of the 50 states in the past 2 or 3 years to have language in a will that gives your executor the ability and the authority to access your online information, to gather your passwords, to be able to access your bank accounts for people who don't write paper checks anymore, mm-hmm. and all your information is online. Your executor is at a loss without having the ability to get those, to get your password, to get access to your accounts. A lot of digital information stored in other forms of online wealth as well. And you can do that in a will, and it's very, very important that people do that either by will or by a power of attorney. Power of attorney won't be any good once you die, so therefore it really should be in the will. That's a very important point you made.
All right, I want to go to the phones. I want to go to Alan in Tamarack. Alan, thanks for joining us. What's your question?
I just wanted to ask, first, in general, what happens if a childless, spouseless person dies without a will? I mean, I have my mom listed as a beneficiary of my bank account, but can I do something like that with my car title? It's like the only other asset.
Okay, so if you die and you don't have a spouse or children, he said that he does have his mother on there. But yeah, what happens when you don't have an heir? You don't have somebody that it would automatically go to?
Well, first of all, obviously the point of having will is to pick the people to whom you would like to leave your assets when you die. But if you don't have a will, and if you've got something that does not pass by a beneficiary designation, you will have heirs at law. Every state has its own statute governing who heirs at law are, and it's different from state to state. In Florida, if you die without a will, it's typically the immediate members of your family, spouse and children. If you don't have a surviving spouse or children, then you branch out to further members of the family, grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, nieces, nephews, and like this. So there will be somebody there. It's just easier and more efficient if you have a will. And if you can have a will, you should get a will rather than letting your assets go by intestacy.
All right, Alan, thank you so much for the call. Hope that helps out. Again, I'm talking with Bruce Stone, a Miami-based attorney who focuses on estate planning. And again, what question do you have about setting up a will or estate? Again, in this era of COVID-19, it's got us thinking a little bit more about our mortality. And it's something that we always think about. It's there. We push it off maybe till later. But maybe we're in a situation where we can't do that anymore. The number again, 800-743-9576. You can always post it on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Mr. Stone, what about when it comes to, I wonder what Florida law says when it comes to witnesses that you need for documents that have to be signed? And you know, in the time of social distancing, how do we deal with that?
We are in a very difficult situation in the state of Florida at the moment. The reason is that almost every document that you would sign as part of a good estate plan, a will, a durable power of attorney to allow somebody to act on your behalf while you're alive but not able to take care of yourself, a healthcare surrogate, somebody to make your health care decisions for you while you're alive but can't do it. A living will, you are in the process of dying, should they continue to intubate you and give you food and water, administer drugs to keep you alive. All of these documents, a trust to avoid probate, all of these documents require two live witnesses in the actual presence of the person signing the document. Other states have different laws. Some states allow witnesses to execute and witness documents online by audiovisual communications like Zoom or Skype. Some will allow handwritten wills without witnesses to be effective. Unfortunately, in the state of Florida, you must have two live witnesses in the presence of the person signing the document. And in one case, for a power of attorney, you must have a notary public as well. And they're just simply, those are very rigid and strictly enforced rules in the state of Florida. I will make note that come July 1, we have legislation that last year's legislature passed in 2019 to allow wills and revocable trusts and some powers of attorney to be executed online with audiovisual witnesses, not in the live presence, but that won't become effective until July the 1st. Unfortunately, not until July 1. So between now and then, you simply have to have two witnesses, and as difficult as it is, your documents at the end of the day under Florida law are not going to be valid without the two witnesses.
Very interesting. Let's go back to the phones. I want to go to Francesca in Miramar. Francesca, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for this. I have a question about, I'm a single woman living by myself, no kids.
Okay.
And I would like to know, I have bought a package to do this on my own through Suze Orman. And if there's any suggestion your guest can give us, can give me about things I should consider, and since I'm thinking of doing this on my own.
Okay. So what should, all right, so yeah, Mr. Stone, what should Francesca be considering as she's drafting her own will? And first, your take on drafting your own will. What do you think about that?
You need to be very, very careful before you start trying to draft your own will. A lot of people may be able to do it, but you just need to be very, very careful. You could be creating a lot of problems that, the sad truth is that will cost more in legal fees to get straightened out after you've passed on than it would be to incur legal fees to get a document done properly. I do want to make just a suggestion. This is a very helpful resource for the public. If you would go online, if you've got internet access, there's an organization called the American College of Trust and Estate Counsel, which has a very helpful video that was just put up about a week ago aimed at members of the public telling that you should consider in getting your own estate planning in order. I'll just give you the site one time. It's CTEC.org, ACTEC.org. There are other organizations that have very helpful information as well. There are also companies online where you can do wills, and I'm not going to name any of them here. That would be an unfair commercial, but there are sites online where individual citizens of the state of Florida can log in and you can have documents drafted. The problem, once again, though, that you run into is those documents must be witnessed by two live persons in your presence. So I would encourage people, rather than trying to draft their own wills out of scratch, if you don't have the ability to see a good professional who can help you, go online and use one of these online resources where you can get some fairly good documents drafted. But again, you got to have them executed in the presence of witnesses.
All right, Francesca, thank you so much for the call. I hope that helped. A couple things that you have to think about there. Mr. Stone, as we wrap up here, coming back again to really when people should be thinking about these things. In normal times, you know, again, we might put it off for a little while because we don't think about our mortality that much. But in these times, what's the advice you give folks as to when they should start and how long that process takes?
You should always start, you know, we all have our to-do list. We all have the things we're always going to get around to doing. You know, it's the wake-up call that makes us think, gee, I really better get around and get this done. And there's nothing like the fear, the terror of, you know, of the horrible prospect that that you might wind up on a gurney in a hallway in a hospital with nobody there to help you, to be with you, you know, in your last moments, to make you realize you really need to get something done. It's never too late. It is too late. It's never too early. If you're thinking about it, you ought to be doing it. If you're thinking about it now, if you're listening to this show, you're thinking about it, and you really ought to be taking steps to do something now. It's better to do something than nothing. Now, I hope for God's sake that we all get all past this, and the virus recedes and things return to normal, but there will be things that will come up again in the future. Please, for the sake of your family and your loved ones, do not put these things off.
Bruce Stone is a Miami-based attorney, again, focusing on estate planning. Mr. Stone, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And again, none of this was legal advice. If you do have legal questions, please seek out an attorney to get actual legal advice. But hopefully some of this is a guidepost to guide you forward in what to think about. And he's right. It's not something we don't like thinking about our mortality. But as we've seen, people who do die of the disease, unfortunately, die alone because family and friends are not allowed to be in there with you. And you want all of this taken care of. So share with us your stories or your questions. Find us again online, Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Still to come, nonprofits are often advocating for the most needy, but how are they surviving the crisis? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Nonprofits have been hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. I mean, think of your local organization that raises money to feed the homeless or advocates for social justice issues. They depend on the generosity of others. But with millions filing for unemployment across the country, that funding has been hit hard. Community foundations across South Florida are looking for ways to help nonprofits survive the times. I mean, like the Community Foundation of the Florida Keys. They granted $30,000 from its Florida Keys Emergency Relief Fund to provide immediate relief to residents affected by COVID-19's economic impacts. So we have a panel conversation right now across our region to discuss the role of the community foundations. Joining us now is Lindsay Linzer. She's a Senior Director of Programs and Grant Administration at the Miami Foundation. Lindsay, great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Also, Linda Carter, CEO of the Community Foundation of Broward. Linda, great to have you as well.
Great. Thank you for having me as well.
And Brad Hurlbert is the President and CEO of Community Foundation for Palm Beach and Martin Counties. Brad, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Okay, so I want to start with this. I want to get a sense from each of you of how this pandemic has impacted the nonprofits and the organizations that you work with regularly. Is it really bad or is it okay right now but getting worse? What's happening right now in your community? Brad, let me start with you. You know, up in Palm Beach and Martin counties, what's been going on with this?
So we're hearing from organizations that are actually going into their line of credit just to keep everything going, wondering if they can even continue. We're finding that those organizations that are serving the most needy in our community are having to do even more than they were asked before with less resources. So it's just been a really gut punch.
Linda, is that the same case in Broward County? And who's getting hit the hardest right now?
The same thing. And what's interesting is the narrative is changing from week to week. So the first week out, everyone had a stiff upper lip and said, you know, we can get through this because that's how nonprofits play. You know, they're, I can do this. And as every week goes on, it's harder and harder for them to provide the services. We've been really impressed with some of the bright spots where folks have pivoted and turned a daycare center now into a feeding site. And so they really are rallying around trying to get the job done. But hey, it's hard for them because their employees are affected by this. Their volunteers are affected by this, as well as the financial implications.
Yeah. And Lindsay, you know, in Miami, in the Miami area, you know, again, I'm just wondering who's being hit the hardest. And interesting what Linda said is that, you know, people thought, yeah, we can get through this. We've been through a lot in Florida, but nothing like this.
Definitely. And most people don't realize that nonprofit organizations often work on a fee-for-service model. So if they're not actually serving clients, they're not going to get reimbursed or paid by funders for the services that they still have to provide, especially in the midst of this crisis. And then there's the arts organizations who really depend on earned revenue. So they just depend on ticket sales and ticket revenues. And because their doors have been closed for the past 4+ weeks, they're really hurting right now and starting to have to lay off staff.
Brad, remind us of what the Community Foundation does, the role of these foundations. And it's, my understanding is really kind of like a stop for a lot of these nonprofits where they can still get that help.
So I look at the Community Foundation as almost that safe place in the community where everybody can come. So it's not just about us. It's also about our other funders, our other collaborators. We have 10 collaborators now, and we share an online application with all those funders so that we can do the best job we can to support the nonprofit community. And really, we look at the nonprofit community almost as our constituency. We want to help them be successful because they're serving our community, but it's a challenge. We've had $20 million in asks in this online portal that we've put together for all our collaborators, and I think we might have 4 to 5 million that we could probably allocate at this point. We're still raising money, of course.
All right. So, in raising that money, what are you leaning on? Is it still donations? Are we talking about state, federal grants, loans? Where's that money coming from?
So, I'm talking about actually mostly individuals, some private foundations, people. We've actually just heard about at the end of last week a company out of Boston that heard about us and is actually making a contribution. So we've had donations from local companies and individuals, and also we have donor advised funds. So people actually hold their donor advised funds with us, and they make grants to the nonprofit community. So some of our grant making has been from actually directly to the nonprofits through funds that we have at the foundation here.
So, Linda, I mean, there's still going to be people and groups that can give, but we don't know how long this will last. So what's the plan? How long can you depend on that?
Well, that's what first of all, thank you so much for hosting this conversation amongst community foundations, because I think that's the main message we want to send out to the communities. Community foundations are uniquely positioned to help right away. We manage hundreds of funds that were created by individuals and organizations that are endowed funds to benefit our community forever. And so we were all able to turn around and support things happening in the community right away because we all have these endowed funds that are benefiting our community. So we were able at the Community Foundation, and I'm confident that Miami and Palm Beach were able to do the same thing. We had $1 million out in grants to begin with, and we were able to reach out to all of the grantees and say, all right, you're not going to be able to do that educational outreach program at the animal shelter, but now go ahead and turn around and keep the facility afloat and feed the animals. So that's the benefit of a community foundation, is the power of working with these endowed funds set up by families and individuals and saying, I want to work where it's the most important. And who knew this was going to happen to our community? But we were there right from day one.
Yeah. We've always been hearing that someday there could be a pandemic. We just never thought about what it could be like. And well, now we're finding out. Lindsay, do you find yourself in a situation where you have to figure out who's going to get the help first, who needs it the most?
Yeah, it's a really tricky situation. Hundreds of nonprofits are calling us, and we're in touch with them talking about their needs because everybody is feeling this crisis right now. And so we are doing our best to be in touch with the nonprofit community. And when we think about the first organizations we're going to support, it's really going to be the organizations on the front lines of this crisis, the people who are still showing up to work to make sure that our community is being fed and housed and has the supplies that they need to ride out this crisis at home. home. And then we'll look to the future. As you know, as my counterparts mentioned, we were invested in the long-term future of our communities. And so while we need to allocate dollars right now for immediate relief, we need to ensure that the dollars are there 6 months from now, a year from now, to really help these organizations rebuild and ensure that, you know, our communities can be resilient in the future.
And it's interesting what you just said and also what I heard from Linda a second ago. So again, it's having these endowments, having this money that can last a long time. But so here's the thing about the pandemic we're finding out, and I'm trying to be positive, but I'm also listening to the experts. One, you know, we don't know how long the stay at home will have to be in place. Two, we don't know if there would be a reoccurrence later, you know, in the year, and how long it's going to take to find the vaccine. It's going to be a while, and so are these foundations ready to go the long distance we may have to go to deal with this, to keep people, to keep the organizations going?
I think community foundations are definitely here for the long term, and that's the benefit of the funds that we have. The individuals who have created funds at community foundations say, we want our dollars out of my name fund to work where it's the most important. Well, that's the benefit over a private foundation is working with your community foundation, because we have our ear to the ground. We're the community knowledge center. We're the experts in philanthropy. We have all the IRS compliance. And so we can ensure those donors that their fund is going to be used where it's needed the most. And you're absolutely right. This is a long-term recovery. We're going to have to look at job training programs. We're going to have to look at mental health programs for those who have been affected by this, because they're working in the trenches and they're burning out. I mean, we're going to be here for the long term, and community foundations will be able to respond to that.
We're talking with Linda Carter, CEO of Community Foundation of Broward. You're also hearing from Lindsay Linzer. She's the Senior Director of Programs and Grant Administration at the Miami Foundation. And Brad Hurlburt is the President and CEO of Community Foundation for Palm Beach and Martin Counties. And you can follow more of our coronavirus coverage at WLRN.org/coronavirus. Brad, in these times, again, most people who need help turn to nonprofits for aid, like food, supplies, housing, help with housing, and so forth. Can we still do that? Because it feels like, again, supplies are limited and people are struggling right now.
I think the nonprofit community is strong. I think there's challenges, but what between the community foundations and all the other folks in the nonprofit, the people who are philanthropic, we're gonna make the best of this. And my hope is we're gonna come out of this stronger in the end. I just think that we're resilient and always positive. We're trying to work with the nonprofits. We're reaching out to them. We're providing. We have a resource page where they can get information about filing for federal programs. We're trying to help them in every way we can to just be as successful as they can be.
And yeah, I'm glad you brought that up as well. When you talk about federal programs, I mean, look, we have the stimulus package that's out there, but even programs that have existed before the CARES Act, do these groups still have access to a lot of those grants or loans? What's available?
So like even I think Linda alluded to this too in Broward, but we're not going to say you have to do this program and you have to do all these requirements. We're going to give you general operating support so you can keep your doors open and you can serve your community the best way you can. We have long relationships with these organizations. We want them to be successful.
Lindsay, I think you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, we're also doing everything we can to unlock dollars, ensure that the organizations have flexible funding to do what they need to do. We know that the projects that they were planning to do may not happen, so we want to give them flexible funding. And we're also trying to give them technical assistance. Last week, in partnership with the Community Foundation of Broward, we had Berkowitz Pollock Grant do a technical assistance training for over 1,000 nonprofit organizations who are applying to federal government programs through the CARES Act, helping them understand what it is they need to apply and how they can access those dollars. And they've also created a 24/7 hotline to help organizations that are actually trying to apply and submit their SBA PPP application. So we're doing everything we can from both providing flexible funding to also providing technical assistance where possible.
But Lindsay, something you said a little while ago is very interesting is, I mean, look, you have those groups that are trying to feed people and those other groups that are trying to help provide basic supplies or housing help to folks. But then you have nonprofits that are providing, you know, entertainment, providing, mm-hmm. again, the arts and things like that. So some things are going to seem more important than others. Is there a concern that if this goes a long time, that there are going to be groups like we see small businesses might disappear?
There is definitely that concern that small businesses, small arts organizations are going to disappear during this crisis. There are amazing groups that have come together to try and provide grant dollars for individual artists in our community and some of those smaller organizations, but the need continues to grow. The longer that we're in isolation and unable to attend these performances, frequent these businesses, the more organizations that are going to be hurt. And so we're trying to do everything we can, from technical assistance to training, providing resources through our website to help these organizations out.
Linda, what is that process when you have so many nonprofits calling and asking where the opportunity is, and what you tell them? And depending on what the nonprofit is, what do you tell them about, where the opportunities are? And I wonder what your concern is, as to what might eventually be lost.
Yeah, I agree with Lindsay's and Brad's observation that, when you think about the nonprofit sector, they are small businesses, and they will be affected, and some will not survive, which will be devastating to our community because the services they provide are really important. I think what we're seeing is that one of the things we'll want to watch in the future is you'll know the health of the community is coming back when you start seeing them going back to concerts and going back into museums and going to festivals. That's when you'll know that we as a community are much stronger. And so all we can do is reach out to those organizations and help them get through this. Sometimes it's just having a conversation and letting them know they're not in it alone and giving them confidences that they're moving in the right direction. I think that's what Lindsay was alluding to on our webinar on the Paycheck Protection Program of the CARES Act. Most nonprofits have never applied for a SBA loan. That's a scary proposition. So helping them navigate and do these uncharted territories so that they can be resilient is really important. And we'll be bringing them together. I know they'll do the same thing in Palm Beach and Miami, bringing nonprofits together once we're out of the whole self-isolation strategies and letting them learn from each other and collaborate and share resources. Because the nonprofit sector is a critical component to our community.
Brad, you said that we're going to be stronger from this. I want to get a sense of what you think is going to make us stronger. How will the system, for providing for nonprofits get better? What are we going to learn from this?
Well, I think in times of distress, when you really have to pull everything you have up and make it happen, you really learn what's important, and you get better because of that. One of the things, as we were looking at our grant making, there was some pressure to just, the need is now COVID-19 response. That's all we're going to do. But we have to be much more than that. We have years and years of experience with this nonprofit community, and we're not just going to completely do COVID-19 response. We're doing response to the whole nonprofit community. We're going to continue our grant making over time. As Linda said, these are endowed funds. This money is going to continue. So we're just going to get better at what we do. We have to.
Lindsay, do any community funds have any of their money invested in the stock market?
So we do use outside financial advisors to invest our funds. And just like every investor out there in the community, community foundations are among those the hardest hit. We have money in long-term pools that have had significant drops. And so we're doing everything we can to protect our funds and, you know, make sure that they are planned. The way we plan our spending is to make sure that we will have funding for the future. So any short-term losses, we're optimistic that just like in past crises, we will come out ahead in the future.
And what about, you know, the normal wealthy funders that contribute? I mean, they've taken a hit too, I'd imagine. And I'm wondering, you know, if you're seeing less donations from them.
So, you know, in the short term, we're not necessarily seeing less donations, but we are hearing from organizations on the ground that they're already starting to hear from some of their funders, some pledges being withdrawn, funding being pulled that was already previously committed. And so we know it is affecting organizations, and we anticipate it will also affect community foundations. We're trying to be optimistic, and we're doing everything we can as a community foundation to really educate our fund holders, those donor advised fund holders, to let them know, please, you know, here's the importance of continuing to invest with us so that we can support our community for the long term. So we're encouraging them also to continue to give directly to the organizations that they always gave to. Even if the gala was canceled, the fundraiser was canceled, please continue to give to those organizations because they desperately need those funds right now.
Lindsay Linzer is the Senior Director of Programs and Grant Administration at the Miami Foundation. Linda Carter is the CEO of the Community Foundation of Broward. And Brad Hurlburt is the president and CEO of Community Foundation for Palm Beach and Martin Counties. Lindsay, Linda, Brad, thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, you can learn more about those foundations. Again, find us at WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Monday, April 13th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, the Scripps Research Institute out of Jupiter, Florida, is on the front lines of new medical research focused on the coronavirus. Dr. Michael Farzan is a virologist, and he'll explain where they are in developing a vaccine. And those struggling with alcohol and substance abuse are facing an even more challenging time. How are AA meetings happening virtually, and do they work? And by the way, WLRN has a brand new biweekly email newsletter. It rounds up all local news about COVID-19. Signing up is free. Just visit WLRN.org/coronavirus. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.